This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Wednesday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto. Beautiful, steamy day in Chicagoland, heading to a high of 86 degrees. And we're going to have some thunderstorms off and on throughout the rest of the week. But the warm temperatures remain as we'll be up around 90 for the highs each day the rest of the week and even through the weekend. Right now, 81 at O'Hare, 83 Midway, and 82 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. The Noon Business Hour is presented by Old Second Bank. Let's kick things off with an update of Wall Street at Bloomberg. Here's Elisa Parenti.
Cisco, we are in the green. The Dow up 76 points or 0.25%. NASDAQ higher by 47 or almost 0.2%. S&P picking up 6. The Bloomberg WBBM Chicago Index down 0.1%. The tech sector is riding higher on the wings of a better-than-expected quarterly report from Micron Technology. Its shares soaring 14%, and Intel and Cisco Systems are going along for the ride. Oil sharply higher today, up almost 3% after a huge drop in U.S. crude stockpiles. That's adding momentum to the gains after the standoff between Washington and Tehran. Crude right now at $59.35. Back to you, Cisco.
Thanks, Elisa. On today's Noon Business Hour, we have lots to cover. It is Personal Finance Wednesday. We'll be talking about preparing students as they head off to college so they are financially sound. Of course, that heading off to college just around the corner. Also, streaming wars are hitting Netflix. Summer has arrived. Back to school sales. Yes, that's right. Already back to school season. And it seems like the kids just got out of school. We'll cover that in our next segment. Right now, the loss of a corporate headquarters can be a big blow to a suburban community. To talk about it, we welcome Bob Reed, business writer and contributor at Chicago Magazine. And of course, this comes as Takeda Pharmaceuticals moving 1,000 jobs out of Deerfield. They're going to try to sell the building, Bob. I don't know necessarily how easy that's going to be these days.
Well, it won't be very easy, and a lot of these suburbs are having to think very differently about their situation since these corporations are relocating. You know, since around 2011, nearly 70 major headquarters or major offices have relocated from Chicago area suburbs and going to the Loop, to the West Loop and River North, and making these different suburbs think twice about what they do with these buildings and what they do with a lot of this land.
Is there really, I mean, I'm thinking at a mall, as malls have changed, it's really easy to sort of make that residential and still have some restaurants and services and that sort of thing, make it kind of a community. But what can they do with these office buildings? They're just big structures that are designed almost with no other purpose.
Well, that's right. And what they have to do is be more aggressive in trying to lure tenants to those kinds of buildings. But as you say, the big issue is these big corporate campuses like you have with McDonald's, which just left Oakbrook, Schaumburg, where Motorola Solutions has left. And they have been forced to rethink, what do you do with these huge tracts of land? And a lot of them are trying to make them urban areas within suburban areas, making them a lot more dense, putting in restaurants, entertainment, even schools. To try to attract millennials and their families.
What does it do to the other businesses in those communities, too? I'm thinking specifically about the restaurants that maybe thrive on that lunch crowd. And now in the case of Takeda, you're taking 1,000 employees out of the neighborhood.
Yeah, it hurts because there is a ripple effect and an economic impact whenever you have a big employer leave like that. So, yes, it has to do with the restaurants, the nearby retail shops. And as you know, a lot of these suburban malls are having their own troubles because of the encroachment of Amazon and online buying and selling. So when you lose a customer base like that, it makes them really hurt.
And when it comes to that, obviously, there's tax dollars at stake, too, because if those service if the restaurants and such are closed, you're losing taxes there. Also, the property is abandoned, so maybe you're not getting as much property tax.
Well, this is the reason why the suburbs have to rethink what they do. If they expect to just swap it out for another big client or a big customer, that's not going to happen. You have to think more creatively about what you do with these spaces, whether it's an office building or a campus. But the big issue always comes down to transportation. Do you have a way of getting people back and forth from these developments? And if so, what kind of new transportation options can you provide? Because public transportation takes you only so far, which means a lot of these suburbs are concentrating on ride sharing and shuttling and whatever they can do to get people to the front door.
Lots to think about. Thanks, Bob Reed. He's business writer and contributor at Chicago Magazine. Just ahead, back-to-school spending expected to rise nearly 10% this year. There is a prime reason why. We'll find that out. And yes, it is already back-to-school shopping. Finally, feels like summer. Retailers looking ahead to the back-to-school season. Parents don't even want to think about that, but lots of people are. We're joined now by Ken Perkins, research analyst at Retail Magazine, based in Swampscott, Massachusetts. Ken, there are parents saying, hey, wait a minute. Kids just got out of school. Let's not talk about back to school yet.
Yeah, that is for sure. It feels, especially in the Northeast and Midwest, you know, it feels like it was just a couple weeks ago that they got out of school. But, I mean, the South is going to be heading back to school in about 6 weeks or so, even less. And given the importance of the shopping season for retailers, it's something that they really try to hype up and get some momentum to building into the season, because it's so important to their bottom line.
Oh, back to school spending expected to rise maybe 10% this year. What's behind that? Why is that going to happen?
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical of the 10% number, just because of everything that's been going on with consumer spending. The economy seems to be slowing down. I think it'll certainly be up. I mean, you still got decent economic growth. Unemployment's below 4%. You know, wage gains are still 3 to 3.5% month to month. So I think there's enough money out there to drive some decent sales growth. 10% seems a bit of a reach, but, you know, we would expect up mid-single digits.
And what is it? I mean, is it new things that parents are going to have to be buying? Is it just new opportunities? I mean, why spend more money? Seems like parents are always looking to save.
Yeah, well, that is true, and they are absolutely always looking to save. And you know, I think the expenditures continue to rise, particularly on the back to college side. You know, everybody thinks back to school, K to 12. You know, and that accounted for about, you know, roughly $28 billion last year. Whereas back to college was closer to $55-56 billion. So it's that back to college number. You know, there are higher ticket items. You're talking about laptops, you're talking about furniture, larger ticket purchases for back to college, and I think that's where the growth is going to be driving and coming from. And you've got stores like a Target who are putting in store within stores, just particularly to focus on that back to college element. I know Best Buy does some of that as well, and really trying to capitalize on the dollars that are being spent there.
And the significance of this for these retail businesses is just huge. I mean, this is essentially like Christmas for them.
It's close. You know, it's by far the second biggest shopping season of the year. What we've seen over the last decade or so is the numbers have sort of been spread out. It's not as heavily concentrated in late August and early September as it used to be. It tends to start in mid to late July now and sort of go all the way through mid-September for back to school. So it is a bit more spread out, more shopping obviously being done online. But it's still a very strong component when you think about roughly $85, $86 billion potentially this year being spent. You know, that's obviously significantly less than the 600 plus billion spent over the holidays, but it's still a very sizable number.
Yeah, significant number, and some deals to be had for parents. Thank you. Ken Perkins, research analyst at Retail Metrics. Up next, the value of Bitcoin climbing again. Is it going to last?
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Bitcoin is on a roll, hitting fresh year-to-date highs. Let's delve into cryptocurrency with Bill Ulivieri, portfolio manager at Senecal Capital Management in Glenview. Bill, to say that this is on a roll, I think it's almost an understatement. It's at about 13,000 now, and it was in the 3,000s just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, it has been one heck of a rally, Cisco. I tell you, I think it's caught a lot of people by surprise, including myself. You know, Bitcoin is up about 320% from the February lows. And I know that it sounds crazy, right? I know everybody's wondering what is going on with Bitcoin, but is it any crazier than the initial public offering that came out recently with Beyond Meat? So here's a company that IPOs at $25 a share and within a few days rallies up to $200 a share. So it's like up 700%-ish. You know, Spotify came out and IPO'd in 2015 at $17 a share. Now that's above $336 a share. So There are crazier things going on than Bitcoin's rally, but I'll definitely put this in the top five of 2019.
You know, what's interesting about Bitcoin, though, or any of the cryptocurrencies, is most people still don't even understand them. They still can't even explain what they are. And yet you have a lot of people putting money in them off and on.
Right. Well, I'll tell you this. You know, if you study the Google Analytics and, you know, there's a four-letter acronym, FOMO, the fear of missing out. What's absent in this rally is the FOMO that was around from the retail investors from 2017. So this rally has been actually a very low volume, kind of quiet rally, very similar to these like summer doldrums that we get into the stock market where we just keep, you know, creeping higher and higher and higher. And then maybe we pull back after Labor Day. So I kind of suspect that the same thing might happen where this is just the summer doldrums, although there are some interesting fundamentals out there that make Bitcoin more attractive. So that might be attracting some new money.
Well, it's one of my questions for you, actually. I'm thinking specifically as bond yields are going down, is Bitcoin now an acceptable alternative for people who are looking to make a little money?
I think the speculators might be thinking that way, Cisco, but in terms of, like, what do we have, if you watch financial news TV, you'll see that there is $13 trillion of negative yield interest rate bonds globally. We have the S&P market, which is roughly a price-earnings ratio maybe in the low 30s, 32 to 36. We have record low yields in bonds. So, yeah, there might be some speculators looking at Bitcoin. But truthfully, I'm wondering if this isn't more of a flight-to-quality move, like we've seen gold and some other precious metals increase in the last few weeks. And if Bitcoin is the new gold, which some people say it isn't. I don't know for 100% for sure. But maybe movement into an alternative asset class, because people might believe there's no safe place to go because, you know, bond market is a little bit iffy, and certainly the stock market is at, you know, all-time highs roughly. So I think it might be a defensive maneuver into a digital currency because, you know, it just might be the next safe haven. We don't really know.
Yeah, you know, it's incredible, though, that if that's the case, if that's what investors are thinking, in a pretty short time, it is turned into something that they feel is safe and at least reliable, and that they don't think it's going away.
Right. Well, you know, we can say that about dot-com stocks in the early 2000s. We can say that about mortgage and financial services companies in 2007. So is there a bubble mentality globally and certainly locally in Bitcoin? I guess it's possible. I mean, I'm not going to rule that out. But there is something kind of, for lack of a better term, you can, when you buy Bitcoin, you own that asset, right? And no one else has a claim to it. And you can't say that about some other financial instruments out there. So, yeah, I think it kind of feels good to own Bitcoin, just like it feels good to hold an ounce of gold in your hand, a little token. There's just something nice about it. And Bitcoin has a deflationary supply, which means of the 21 million tokens that there will ever be, roughly 18 million are already spoken for. So you have more dollars going after fewer tokens, which again has this supply-demand aspect that we've never really experienced before, because most exchange-traded funds almost have like an unlimited number of shares you can buy. So a mutual fund, almost an unlimited number of shares.
Yeah, very, very different. Thank you, Bill Ulivieri, Portfolio Manager, Senecal Capital Management in Glenview. By the way, just since Bill and I have been talking here over the last couple of minutes, Bitcoin up another $100. WBBM News Time, now 12:23. Your new time for business news at Bloomberg. Here's Elisa Parenti.
Cisco, we've got gains with the Dow up 72 points, NASDAQ higher by 43 or more than 0.5%, S&P adding 4 points. The Wintrust WBBM Chicago Index from Bloomberg is sliding 0.25%. We have a check on the grains markets. For that, we turn to Pete Manhart at Bates Commodities in Normal. Pete?
We have mixed prices in the grains. December corn down a penny at 456 and a half. It's been two-sided. The beans for November down 5 and a quarter. At 921 and a quarter, and wheat now up 6 at 541 and three quarters, 4 off its high and 10 off its low. And this is Pete Manhart at Bates Commodities Normal. You can reach us at 800-779-1515.
Thank you so much, Pete. I'm Elisa Parenti, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
On Wall Street, the Dow up 50, NASDAQ is up 34, and the S&P is up 1 point. Oil is up 2.5%. Beautiful sunshine all day long and warmer. It's going to be warm for the next several days. High today of 86 degrees. Right now, 81 O'Hare, 83 Midway, and 82 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. Markets are higher at this hour. To talk about it, we're joined by Tim Grisky, Chief Investment Strategist at Inverness Council, based in New York, and the Noon Business Hour presented by Old Second Bank. Tim, a little movement upward today. What are you seeing on Wall Street?
Well, we were stronger earlier in the day, Cisco, than we are now, but the market is still positive. The early tone was set by Mnuchin's comments that the trade deal or trade agreement with China was 90% done. I think that gave the market some early optimism. But 10% is probably the toughest last part of the any negotiation. I think we still are very far apart, the Chinese and the U.S., with this. But anything positive coming out of this meeting between Xi and Trump will be greeted favorably by the markets, even if it's just a indication that we'll try to reschedule some talks or schedule some talks again.
In the end, obviously, a lot of people would enjoy changes in some of the business practices that China engages in, especially with intellectual property. But will investors just be glad to get the tariffs gone?
Well, I think, I don't think Trump is going to roll over about the intellectual property rights, patent rights, and everything that really China takes and uses and doesn't pay for. So I think that's really the big part of this negotiation. That's probably the sticking last 10% of all this. The tariffs are certainly disruptive economically. I think companies don't know what to do in terms of producing goods, building inventories, using inventories. So there's a lot of confusion right now in corporate America. So anything that stabilizes the outlook for corporate America is certainly going to be a positive.
And they're seriously hearing good things, at least. Like you say, 90%, 10%, still a long way to go, but we're at least getting positive news ahead of this meeting.
Exactly. I think, likely the two of them are going to sit down and at least agree to do something, hopefully talk, and hopefully these two leaders can get together and come up with a good solution.
Let's talk about Boeing. Been just some interesting video and pictures of these grounded 737 MAX planes literally taking over an employee parking lot. They can't fly the planes. They have to park them somewhere.
And I think they're going to stay parked for a while here. Having said that, though, actually Boeing is up over 2% today, and the stock has actually been acting much better. And I think the thought here is that they're moving towards some type of resolution of this issue in terms of getting the planes airworthy and back in service. It's not going to happen probably before year end, but the anticipation of that, I think, is helping this stock, which of course has been battered by this whole issue. There are these reimbursement conversations they're having with airlines. In terms of the grounding, this is going to cost Boeing certainly some money, but it's going to probably be a one-time hit. So at some point, this is a very interesting stock and might already be one.
In spite of the fact that obviously a lot of people are concerned with that particular plane, and there's at least been some talk of maybe having to change the name of the plane, Boeing and a lot of airlines have to continue to rely on this just because there's so many of them that were in service.
Exactly. So they have to deal with it. They have to get these planes fixed, and they have to come up with a way of getting the flying public comfortable with flying in these planes. So and I don't think all of that has occurred yet. I'm not sure I'd want to step on one of these planes, no matter what anybody said at this point. But it's a PR nightmare for Boeing, and they have to deal with it, and they have to get the flying public comfortable again. That's the big challenge ahead.
Yeah, I actually found myself, I've never even paid attention to this, but when you check in for a flight on an app on your phone, it actually tells you the plane that you're going to be flying on. I've never paid any attention to that, and now I'm sure I'm not the only one who's looking to see if it will it be a 737 MAX someday?
Right, exactly. Or, you know, probably not a bad idea to change the name. That will fool a lot of us, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So in this environment, still not sure about trade, even though there are at least some good signals. What sort of advice do you give to investors as they're thinking about where to move some money?
Well, I think the big positive out there is certainly the Fed. The Federal Reserve is likely to lower interest rates in their meeting at the end of July. The question is how much will they, you know, lower rates, and will they indicate that they may lower rates even further at subsequent meetings? But having the Fed working with you and lowering interest rates really should benefit the economy here. It should help in terms of the housing market and lower mortgage rates. It should help companies lower their costs, and it should be a real stimulus to the economy and keep us away from that bad R word, that recession word, which pops up every once in a while as a potential issue out there, not in the immediate term, but, you know, somewhere out there. If the Fed is lowering rates, it really will help the economy.
Thanks so much for the insight. Always good to have you with us. Tim Griske, Chief Investment Strategist at Inverness Council in New York. Up next, Personal Finance Wednesday, making financial preparations as students head off to college.
Money Talks, as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday on the Noon Business Hour, and this afternoon, we're focusing on getting college students ready to handle money when they're away from home. We're joined by Mark Horner, Wealth Advisor at Fairhaven Wealth Management in Oak Brook, editor of MillionDollarCupOfCoffee.com. Mark, before we get into some of the details of how young people can be prepped, we could probably say just about all of this stuff applies to any young person, even if they choose to go into the workforce instead of going to college.
Absolutely, Cisco. And I think the common theme before any of the details is just getting good habits started early, and so that they can stick with that throughout their working life. And I think, you know, one way to start is understanding that not all the money that you make from your job can go to fund stuff. And so a rule of thumb for adults is allocating your income 50-30-20. So 50% to the things that you need, like the groceries and paying the rent or the mortgage, 30% wants, and 20% towards savings or investing. I think a modified version of that for young people might be just 50-50, that 50% goes to the fun stuff, going out with your buddies, while the other 50% should go to get started savings. And that's, I think, a good way for a young person to realize not all those dollars that come in from a paycheck can just be used for fun stuff.
Sounds like you're saying that we have to teach them how to create a budget, or, as I prefer to say, a spending plan. A budget just sounds too constraining.
Yeah, budget just takes the air out of the room, the word does. So I like that. I like that modification, a spending plan.
So what you're going to do that, you're going to say focus on savings, focus on bills, focus on needs, focus on fun, and really show them, in addition to that, how they can take some of that money and maybe put it to work for them, whether it's retirement or just savings or what have you.
Absolutely. And so young people, I think a great way to get started on that savings piece is with a Roth IRA. So money goes into a Roth IRA after taxes have been paid. And so in theory, a young person is going to be at a lower tax bracket. They've also got a lot of time to let that money grow for them. And so to get started contributing to a Roth IRA early is a great way towards moving towards a long-term goal like retirement. And I think important for young people to look at, you know, the day-to-day volatility of the stock market, to remember that over long periods of time, the stock market has been a great place to invest. In fact, it's never had a rolling 20-year period where it's lost money. So thinking about a 30 or 40-year time horizon, getting started investing in the stock market is a great place to start.
And in addition to that, let's talk about getting the money in order to invest in the stock market, that job. Is it a good piece of advice for people to let their kids and encourage their kids to have a job when they're in college, or should they just focus on the studies?
You know, I think it's important to strike a balance between those two things. Unfortunately, with the cost of college education, I think gone are the days when kids can actually put themselves through college with a summer job, but I think absolutely important to get some work experience in addition to that educational experience, and help kind of sow the seeds to identify opportunities for work. And so learning how to network, learning how to interact with people professionally, I think all those experiences are very good for young people to weave into the college experience.
Good advice. Thank you. Mark Horner, Wealth Advisor at Fairhaven Wealth Management, editor of MillionDollarCupOfCoffee.com. This time tomorrow, Technology Thursday. Still to come, the battle for the streaming audience enters a new phase.
Information to make cash and save cash. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The sitcom The Office, the most watched show on Netflix last year, will be leaving the service at the end of 2020, heading to NBC's new streaming channel. Let's get the latest on the streaming wars from Tom Lason, president of New Media Solutions and NewMediaSolutions.tv. Tom, so The Office is heading away from Netflix, and Netflix certainly has enjoyed having it there.
They sure have. You know, there's nothing like being able to buy the rights to a hit show. Content is king, and this is proving that. But you have to also ask yourself how Netflix is going to proceed going forward. They kind of had some beginner's luck. They created some hit shows and said to themselves, well, gosh, this is easy. So we have these rights we've bought. We've got the major network's killer content. We've got our own killer content. Everything looks good going forward. Well, uh-oh, guess what? Content is king. The networks don't necessarily want to sell you the rights to those programs wholesale if they can find a way to start their own channel and turn around and sell them retail. Why wouldn't you? So you're going to see this fractionalization of the streaming universe.
Which seems like it's going to cause Netflix to have to spend even more money on more original content.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's trying to create hit shows is a huge cash suck. Talent is spread thin. Finding that hit show, like I said, early on to them, I think it kind of felt easy. They had a few, but they're about to find out what a slog it is, that they are going to have to produce and launch 15 new things to maybe get one hit, they hope. The success ratio is low, and Netflix is going to be subject to that just like everybody else. And they're going to lose their backbone to some degree of these shows that already exist that they're able to pay wholesale for, because the owners of that content have decided to do their own thing.
Now, let's talk about that, because you have so many different streaming services now that are launching. At some point, the consumer is going to say, hey, I don't want to pay this monthly fee to have all of these different streaming services, and there's going to be some winners and losers.
Oh, absolutely. I have said for years on this program, too, that I think all these dongles and USB hubs and HDMI ports and the boxes that are stacking on top of my television, that it looks like Frankenstein. This is clearly a transitional technology. You've had this aggregation and now this fragmentation. I think the next step is going to be a new form of aggregation, probably web-based, with real strong tools on the IP side that allow the user to create their own a la carte menus. They create their own cable television, if you will, through the IP pathway into their homes. It's going to be complex. I don't know what it's going to look like. There are some major technical hurdles to overcome when it comes to things like listing services and those kinds of things. But that's how I see it going long term. Don't ask me to explain it, though.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, it really is a challenge, and to see where it's going is a challenge, too. I guess what each of the networks is hoping for, in Disney and other places, is that they have one or two hits that people want so badly that they'll be willing to pay for it and maybe pay for all of them.
Yeah, and here we kind of go back into the wheelhouses of the long-term content creators, the Disneys of the world, the Paramounts of the world, people who have that experience, that have that bank account to be able to do that. And I think the model's changing a little bit, too. You know, Netflix is built for binging. Episodes don't have a satisfying conclusion. You've got to go to the next one and then the next one. Whereas these more snackable style shows that the networks create that come and go and begin and end in 25 minutes, they're a little bit of a different model. So how is the consumer going to react to that? Is the old model going to prevail even in a new environment? I think those are a lot of the interesting questions we have going forward, and to see if Netflix can sustain its spend.
Yeah, fascinating to be watching this. Thank you, Tom Lason, president of New Media Solutions and NewMediaSolutions.tv. WBBM News Time 12:53, your new time for business news. At Bloomberg, here's Elisa Parenti.
Cisco, not quite the gains we had earlier in the session, but we're still higher. The Dow up 29, NASDAQ gaining 29, or a third of a percent. S&P picking up just a fraction of a point now. The Wintrust WBBM Chicago Index from Bloomberg had been lower. It is still lower, down a third of a percent. Factory orders for durable goods dropped for a second month in May, down 1.3%. The grounding of Boeing's 737 MAX is mostly responsible for that drop. When you take out planes, orders for business equipment posted the largest gain in 4 months in May. That's a sign factories are still busy and that sector is showing some strength. Crude oil futures continue to gain, up almost 3% to $59.40. With business now at 23 and 53, live from Bloomberg, Elisa Parenti, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.